Good morning, world. Is it spring yet? Not yet, I guess.
I think it's fake spring.
Fake spring. All the crocuses are up, and they're going to get zapped by snow tomorrow.
Well, we hope not, but they're pretty bold.
Yes. Well, anyhow, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And we're a whole lot better about food and wine and other things like that than we are about gardening, just in case you were wondering. So this is not about to become a gardening show.
That's for sure, yes. Although I do love it. I love what you get from the garden, and I like vegetables more than flowers,
There you go, yeah. So those people who have plant flower gardens are doing the wrong thing. But that's got nothing to do with today's program.
No. Actually, you know, Seattle, I think it is putting in the very first food forest, which is, it's a park, but instead of having just ornamental things like most parks or just open space, they're going to have all edible plants.
Well, they're very advanced up there. They already have a park on top of the freeway called the Freeway Park, which is a conventional park with trees and plants and that kind of thing. So it's not surprising, I guess, they're going to be doing something else innovative.
Yeah, they're going to have fruit trees nut trees.
That's what they do. That's what they do up there.
Blueberry bushes and, yeah.
They do that because it rains all the time.
Yeah. So but, you know, anybody could come and take whatever they want. And I vaguely remember, even though everyone says this is the first attempt at such a thing, I remember some place where things were free and commercial peeps came in and stripped everything off and then made a profit out of it. So I don't know.
That sounds about right. But anyway, are we going to do an On the Menu program
today? Yes, we are. Okay. In fact, this is one of those shows that I think I wish we had video, because this first interview is about a two-volume book that, well, it's just gorgeous to see. It's called Notes from a Kitchen. And let's just listen here to see Jeff Scott's explanation of how it came about and what it's supposed to do for you. Well, now, Peter was just joking with Jeff Scott that he was going to sue him because he injured his shoulder lifting these books. I'm talking about Notes from a Kitchen in two volumes. Jeff, you didn't plan for the book to be this big, did you?
No, it just kept on growing and growing and growing. It's like a child that we've watched grow into an adult.
Well, it's a complicated concept. It actually confirms something I've been saying all along for this whole year. Notice that the whole nature, the essence of what we know as cookbooks, it's totally changed. This sort of culminates the whole thing. You are an artist, a photographer, filmmaker, a fine artist, and you have a streak of historical interest and involvement, too. And you co-produced this with a chef, Blake Beshore, is it?
Beshore, yes.
Beshore. I think I'm going to just throw this on to you. Could you please explain what this huge two-volume culinary book is?
Well, it's sort of a chance for looking at trying to read. I mean, my history is in sort of looking at, I just finished 10 years working on with Elvis Presley's estate, documenting Elvis Presley's private artifacts, kind of telling a story about who Elvis was as a man, not the legend, but just as a daily, who was he on a day-to-day basis. And by looking at his driver's license and his gun collection, or his badge collection, his police badge collection, who was he privately? And it occurred to me that there were a lot of books out there on cooking, that a lot of cookbooks featuring recipes, a lot of ways in which to try to say, this is, if you make this, become a better cook. But the idea to me was that a chef's life really couldn't be commoditized within just a list of recipes. I mean, recipes are great, and there's great, great books out there. Ideas in Food is one that I really adore in terms of really understanding food and how it's made and how to become a better chef. But my history is really about spending time on the personal level with human beings or with historical subjects. So I thought, what if I could spend an enormous amount of time with some of the great chefs of our time in their personal lives, at their home, in their kitchen, out on the farms? What if I could spend time with them as they write down notes in their journals and get to know them as human beings? And what if we could let the chefs sort of speak for themselves? So as opposed to a book where I'm imposing my will, if you will, why would I impose what to say? Why not just let a book grow and become as large as it needs to be. Give each chef as many pages as is necessary based on the creativity that is brought about by us hanging out together. And let the chefs tell their story in their own words. So this is just a chance to document a chef's creative life and the whole process of the nature of food, where it comes from, how a chef synthesizes all the information and people around them, and then ends up putting that food onto a plate. So it seemed like an idea for a new kind of cookbook, a time for a new way in which to make, to look at the vision, but to look at it on a much more humble, kind of a quiet enterprise.
Did you know that chefs actually did keep their little notebooks when you started? Did you even know that?
Well, honestly, Peter, I really did, because I know that I keep these journals. All creative people keep journals. I think most people, if they're honest, they keep diaries of some sort, you know, whether it's a logbook or a journal, or even if it's scrap pieces of paper that they write on, or napkins that they, you know, make notes of. I think these private notes that we keep for ourselves are really, if you look back on my notebook, what I wrote down years ago, I'm doing those things today. And I think the interesting thing for me is to, these chefs don't usually give access to their private, you know, they say some really raw things in these books. And but if you could look into somebody's notes and their private diaries, you know, what will it reveal about who they are? And I was surprised that so many people were open to it. I think there was sort of a trust factor that was built over time, where they just really became very fearless in sort of sharing these notes with me. And these notes are really good windows into who they are creatively and personally. So, yeah, I was hopeful that they would show them to me, and I'm pretty honored that they did.
I loved Sean Brock's statement that he thought some of these notes that he made, his ideas from 10 years ago, were brilliant, and now they're really close to embarrassing.
The funniest thing about Sean Brock is his commanding use of what we call the great Australian adjective.
I mean, Sean is a culinary evangelist. Sean is so passionate about the history of food. He's so passionate about people not destroying what used to be so great. One of the things that he really imparted upon me was that if you could, you know, his seedsman, Glenn Roberts from Anson Mills, he took me up there, and he's in Columbia, South Carolina. And Glenn is the one who kind of introduced Sean to seed saving. The idea that Sean is so passionate about this kernel of corn, or this Carolina rice that went into the Carolina rice kitchen, and the whole history of rice, the whole history of the South is contained within a cuisine and is being carefully nurtured through Glenn Roberts. So Sean is really passionate about the idea of, what did the carrot taste like 200 years ago? What does sesame or benne, what does it actually taste like? And what if we could just get one of these seeds, and we could kind of replant and reharvest this thing that used to be so beautiful but been so destroyed over time through genetic modification? And when you go and you taste Sean's produce, whether it's from Thackeray Farm at Wadmala Island, or whether it's McClellanville with Maria Baldwin at Thornhill, you get a sense of the passion all these people have towards really, really holding on to American history through the cuisine. And you get a sense of what actual flavor can taste like if you just don't mess with it and you just let it become what it used to be. So I think Sean, especially with Husk, the whole aspect of nothing comes in the door unless it's from the South.
Oh, yeah.
It's so much about letting people sort of get back to the roots.
He's a natural, an obvious choice. How many did you do? 10 chefs? Okay, well, choosing Sean Brock is certainly along these lines is natural. But then we had it, I think you featured 10 different chefs. What criteria did you use? How did you find them, and what criteria did you use selecting the ones you did for this book? And you might as well tell us who they are.
Sure. No, and that's actually a great question. I mean, I love that question. The chefs in the book, really the nice thing about this book is that so many of these chefs are friends with each other, and there wasn't a lot of effort in terms of, it wasn't a struggle to get the chefs in the book. I became friendly with Emma Hurst, and then Emma introduced me to George Mendez over at Aldea.
I love George. Yeah.
George is brilliant, brilliant. And then George introduced me to Johnny Izzuni. And so Johnny and I became friends, and Johnny and I were hanging out. And then one night he was supposed to go to dinner with George and Sean, but he couldn't make it. He's like, he sent me instead. He goes, hang out with my buddy Sean. And I had no clue who Sean was at the time. And so I just went and hung out with Dominique Ansel and George and Sean, and we were just drinking bourbon. Of course.
Why not?
Why not? And we just became friends, and I still didn't know who he was. And then when I left, I was just like, that guy's really cool. And then George is like, don't you know who that is? And I'm like, no, man. And he's like, well, that's Sean Brock, and he just won the James Beard. And so, I mean, I think that's the nice thing about this book, is that really these people are friendly with each other, and everyone sort of introduced me to their friends. And that's kind of the approach I've become very close with all the chefs in the book as well. And I think that's sort of the kind of the humble vibe that we wanted, which is just kind of just tell a nice, quiet story about who everybody is and what they do on a day-to-day basis. Make a really provocative book. I mean, this book is filled with really provocative imagery and storytelling in a way that hasn't been done. But at its core, it's just a story about 10 people, and it's a story about their lives day-to-day. And what would you learn if you could hang out with Sean Brock for a month? What would you learn if you could hang out with Johnny or with George or with Michael Lisconis or Zach Palacio?
It's interesting. You could learn the secret to how to obtain a supply of the best bourbon in the world. We understand that somebody induced you into overconsumption of a product.
Now you found my secret. Now you found the way in which I did this book. It was to find out, how do I get my best supply of Pappy Van Winkle?
There you go. So we're talking about this wonderful bourbon, and I was relating to you that the last time we were at Husk in Charleston, South Carolina, with Sean Brock, Julian of the Van Winkle family, which owns the product that we're talking about, was actually standing there at the bar. And it's really curious. He had such a laid-back attitude, because I said, demand is great, isn't it? Isn't that a wonderful thing? He said, the problem is, Peter, he says, it takes me 8 years to make any more. It's no good getting excited. Now, Sean Buck's secret was he figured out that if you bought a barrel, then you would always have a supply. So if Sean didn't tell you that, now you know. And now you can spend all your royalties from this book making sure that you have an adequate supply of Pappy Van Winkle.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you a couple of funny stories. I live in Austin, Texas, and I was trying to get a bottle of 23-year-old or even 20-year-old or even 15-year-old, and I wasn't able to find any anywhere. I just kept going from store to store to store, and I was trying to find out, this is just ridiculous because Texas is a big state. And it turned out this was the end of last year, and the reason we had none is because the truck was hijacked coming from Memphis.
Oh, what a terrible thing.
Yeah, so this truck had the 20 and 23, and it was completely jacked. So Texas ended up with, like, you know, 6 cases for the entire region for, like, the next year and a half. So fortunately, I scored a bottle of 23 and another bottle of 20. And then, of course, if I go to Charleston, I get to hang out with Sean, and I usually will spend the night at his house or two or three. And he's got these flasks that Julian uses in order to pull, you know, Julian mixes
right
in the different barrels to create this incredible flavor. I mean, people are always wondering how he can decide, and it's really his palate is so beautiful, his palate is so perfect, that he can grab from these different barrels and really pull together these amazing blends, and just this beautiful, beautiful bourbon. And Sean has these flasks, and one night we were just taking shots out of all these different flasks that were right from the barrel. And then I have these beautiful photographs of Sean in the book making a Julian. It's really detailed, really, I think Sean calls it a complicated damn cocktail, you know?
They're good, really good photos, yeah.
It's a journey. I think it's a journey to understand, you know, if there's shots of Sean in the book where he's polishing the bottle with his hand, and you can see him making, just loving on the bottle. You know what I mean? You can see the affection he has. He looks over to it. He cradles it in his arms. There's sort of an affection for this bourbon is an affection for Julian, and there's affection for the process that it took to make it. I think that's why this bourbon, Pappy Van Winkle, is just so ridiculously tasty, is because there's just so much inherent. He's got the same palate as a chef would, except he's making the most incredible bourbon on earth.
Did anybody find the hijackers?
No, I think they got away.
Oh, that's criminal.
That's kind of like the joke about the guys who hijacked a truckload of Viagra. And police reported that they were searching for a group of hardened criminals.
That's brilliant.
The interesting thing is you never got the integral piece of information about Pappy Van Winkle that I discovered, being a man of great sensitivity and great exploratory powers. I discovered that, in fact, the family that makes Pappy Van Winkle used to make Old Fitzgerald.
Sure.
Which many people thought at the time was the very best bourbon that was around. And apparently, in order to be able to focus their attention on a newer product and on an even better version, they actually sold off the Old Fitzgerald label several years ago and decided they would focus their attention on doing something really great.
Get back to the book here.
I'm getting back to the book right now, because the interesting thing is the passion that you and Sean both reflect about Pappy Van Winkle bourbon is repeated time and time and time again in the passion of the individual chefs in this book and the people that they deal with who produce the products that they work with. So whether it's meat or vegetables or, you know, whatever the connection is to the people who essentially make these chefs famous by producing products which are so wonderful.
And I mean, that's the essence of the book, too. Is, I mean, I think if you look and see what all these chefs are discussing time and again, it's they go back to the product, and a chance to go on numerous farms and hang out with some wonderful farmers. Maria Baldwin being one, Sean Thackeray being another, Richard Starkey or with Starkey Farm outside of Tucson, and getting your hands on dirt and learning about the quality of dirt and learning how to keep rodents away from the dirt, and this incredible passion that farmers have towards nurturing the soil and being really, they're really nurturing our lives by holding on to these historical grounds that produce these incredible crops. And I think that the home cook really can take away from the passion of listening to what all these chefs are saying is that you need to have these relationships with your purveyors. You need to go out to your farm, your local farm. You need to go out and pull these products from the ground and you cook with whatever you can pull out of the ground that day. And it's the same thing when I hang out with in New York with Johnny and George when we go to the markets and I watch them pull things from the markets and then go into George's kitchen. He lays out the stuff on the counter and he says to his cooks, okay, well, what can we do with these products? So they're literally pulling things as fresh as they can find them, and that's what's really giving things an amazing flavor, is learning how to really accentuate what that beautiful essence of that product is and get out of its way. Sean, for instance, just came back from Japan where he did the Cook It Raw seminar, and he really speaks to the idea of minimalism on a plate and trying to reduce things down and reduce things down so much so that, and we just had with the opening, the book signing 3 weeks ago at Aldea with George, we had Sean came in and cooked with George and then also Michael did dessert, and Sean did this beautiful thing with a single carrot and then he had scallop with truffle and he had just antebellum oats, and it was just the most minimalistic plate, yet the flavors were just exploding. And I think he's really focusing right now on how to structure his plate so that there's not as much in the way, but then the flavors just really impact you in a very strong way. And I think this idea of understanding, Johnny speaks at length about texture and about adding texture to something changes every single bite that you eat, and that if you don't have texture, you have no depth. And so I think texture is as important as flavor, and I think the home cook should understand those kinds of ideas. So there's a ton of unique little ideas that chefs speak to about what makes their food so special, that while it's not following a recipe per se, it's an idea or a concept about the nature of food itself, about the, how food is grown, produced, procured, and then what are the things that are being done inside the kitchen to make these foods have these incredible flavors, which ultimately just bring you these really profound memories. You're really eating memories. You're eating moments in your life. You're marking time with these foods, these flavors that you're putting in your mouth.
Jeff, I think we ought to clarify something here. This is not about recipes. You're not passing around recipe, right?
No, this book is not about recipes. This book is about, it's more like a documentary film.
Okay, now that's the next thing is, because we're now talking to a radio audience, and the most important thing, one of the unique characteristics of these two volumes, Notes from a Kitchen, I don't even know if we've actually mentioned that, A Journey Inside Culinary Obsession, is the visuals. How are we going to explain to readers what the visuals are?
Well, the visual, the books are meant to be an adventure. The books are meant to be really a physical, before you open them up, they have no jackets. All the books are etched. There's markings inside the covers. So they're physical, tactile, almost a museum artifact where you can physically hold it and it already excites your senses by the touch. And as you run your fingers over, there's grooves and gullies and valleys inside the covers. And then you open the covers and there's sheets of vellum pages. So I want the viewer to sort of relate to the note-taking that these chefs do by actually touching and feeling their notes and having this emotional reaction to the notebooks and the handwriting of these chefs themselves. So there's all these layering information, layering effects that are being put to use sort of on a way to communicate information about who the chefs are in a way that I don't think has ever been expressed before. So there's a fine art aspect to the book. And then there's hundreds, there's I think about 12 or 1,300 photographs in the book. So the photographs were taken as a documentary film. I shot film with a film camera, then I shot with stills as well. And I cut up the pieces and spliced them back together again. So there's a documentary film that's really placed inside the pages and presented inside a book. So it's almost as if you're looking at a movie of Johnny Izzouni hanging out at home. A movie of Johnny mixing drinks in his home bar where he has maybe 150 bottles of incredible spirits.
Boxing.
Yeah, and then Johnny's boxing, so he wants to relieve some energy. So Johnny's like, I'm really there to hang out to see whatever he would do in his normal life. So he's just taking his hands and he's punching at the bag and releasing this energy. And then later I've got him on his motorcycle doing wheelies in the street. And then he's in the pastry kitchen in prep, and I'm watching him, you know, in the chocolate room with his team, and then all the way up and through service. So you're seeing the whole lifespan within the course of obviously 70, 80, 90, I think Johnny is like 120 pages, but it's giving you enough pages, enough time, that you can actually go over and look at their lives through visual storytelling. So whether it's building a plate, so you're getting a chance to watch the texture being actually applied, whether it's watching the emotional life of a chef being expressed on a page. So the idea with the book's visuals was to express, give enough pages per chef. In this case, it would mean Sean has almost 300 pages. Johnny's 120. George is like 120. And that's how this book sort of got up to almost 1,000 pages, is that I just wanted to take my time with every human being and let them kind of express who they were through visuals, through... I mean, I was just photographing them day after day, and I carry tape recorders with me everywhere I go, so I'm always talking to them and just having dialogue and conversation like we are, and I'm just recording every single thing they say, and then it was just... I ended up with thousands of pages of transcripts of just unbelievable dialogue about them just talking about their lives or talking about food. So this book is meant to be... I mean, most cookbooks, I love... I think 11 Madison Park is pretty brilliant. I think they do a, I think that's about a beautiful, as beautiful a book as I've seen. I think Modernist Cuisine is obviously brilliant. And I think the Alinea book is lovely. But there seemed to be missing in everything I was seeing, there seemed to be, not with those books, because those books really are iconic in and of themselves, but cooking is such an emotional process that there seemed to be missing this idea of an emotional cookbook, a cookbook that kind of grabbed you and pulled you in and took you inside the kitchen. I'm inside the kitchen for days and days and days, almost like a line cook with a camera. And I wanted to put the audience in there with me. If there's, you know, if Johnny Izzouni's going to punch in a bag, boom, I want to put you inside Johnny's home with him. And if George Mendez is in the middle of service and they're firing tickets, it's, you know, where they're doing 150 covers and there's a lot of action, I'm right in the center of the action documenting what's going on, shot after shot after shot after shot, so that you feel like you're in the kitchen with them. And through this process of a visual storytelling medium and using 70, 80, up to maybe 300 pages even in one chef, I think it's a really authentic, exciting, thrilling way to get into the process of cooking and try to understand the nature of cooking and how these chefs even do what they do.
Right. We just got back from Madrid, and we were in one of the fine art museums there, and I looked around and I saw somebody touching a sculpture. I said, sweetheart, why is that guy touching this sculpture? Surely that's not allowed. And then Anne was smart enough to notice that, in fact, he was blind and his white cane was leaning up against the wall. But this was his way of experiencing a visual experience. We saw him later with another sculpture doing the same thing. What I'm wondering is, did you and Anne and Peter, did we succeed in communicating the dimension of photographs when we can't show people the book, or is the answer they just have to go buy one?
Yeah, and I think that this book is meant to be an emotional storytelling adventure. I mean, I really think that this book is a huge book, so you're not going to read this. It's going to take months to go through the book, and it's not meant to be looked at quickly. It's meant to be experienced over time. And I mean, I think the idea is for you to have a really close connection with who these chefs are. Hopefully you get to know Sean Brock much better, George Mendez, Johnny Izzouni, Michael Lascunas, Zach Colaccio has a beautiful section, Emma Hurst has a beautiful section, Jason Aroni has a really emphatic, Jason speaks about plates, he wants his plates to look as if they fell from the sky. I want this book to be an adventure for the reader, that a way in to understand the world of great renowned chefs, that to understand how amazing food is really produced. And the book uses a lot of really sort of innovative, creative means in order to get you there, in order to kind of let you become a part of the experience. So I think it, and it, then of course the aspect of not being sold, we're only selling in private bookstores. So
that's why don't you tell people how to get this book? Because that's not so easy.
Sure. I really wanted, because there was so much money put into the production of the book, and there was no way to run this in a traditional publishing model. So what we did is we set up our own publishing company called Tatru, and we published it ourselves, and it's being sold either exclusively on our website, which is notesfromakitchen.com, or you can get the book at the most fine independent bookstores in the country, either Kitchen Arts and Letters, or Omnivore Books, or Rabelais Books, or Books for Cook, and Heirloom Book Company in Charleston, South Carolina. So I think the idea here was to create something really, really beautiful, really unique, really one of a kind, and to put it into the most really beautiful bookstores in the country, really small independent bookstores that could have the kind of love for affection for books that people used to have. And I think people will be surprised with the emotionality of this book, and I think people are going to learn an awful lot about cooking that they never knew existed. Before this.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff, for your passionate description of the project.
Yeah, we could have talked for hours.
we could, but we have to let you go, and we have to return to our listeners to another part of the program. So thank you once again for your contribution to On the Menu.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Ann. I really appreciate
Jeff.
It.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, we're back. You're back with On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and this is Peter, just in case you're confused. Isn't it funny? We get lots of phone calls, and most of them are for Ann, and they always respond, Ann, when I answer the phone, as though my wife's voice has suddenly become very much deeper.
Yeah,
I don't really quite understand that one, but that's got absolutely nothing to do with.
You know, I just figured out the name of our next guest is Eli Cairo.
Yes,
and his company, his salumi company, is called Olympic Provisions, and yes. I just figured out why.
Yeah, exactly, because he's Greek.
Yes, did you know that?
Well, I knew it was Greek.
But did you know that? Did you figure that out?
I never really thought about it.
I just looked at it. Let's just
set the stage.
You'll love this, listeners.
Well, hold on just a second. I want to set the stage for the rest of the program.
Okay.
Because Eli, or Elias, I guess is his given name, is the first of three interviews completing the rest of the program, which are all about products. Products which in and of themselves are extraordinary. And we'll have each person explain just why they're extraordinary. But first up then, it's Elias Cairo from Portland, Oregon, talking all about Olympic Provisions Salumi.
Well, we've just found one other thing we love coming out of Portland, Oregon, which is probably one of my most favorite places in the country, except for the weather. We're talking to Eli Cairo, and you have a wonderful pedigree for what you do at Olympic Provisions and your salumi making. Just mention some of your background. You're of Greek heritage, but your family has been tied into food for how long? Tell our listeners what you were telling me before.
Yeah, so my father's a first-generation Greek. He moved to Salt Lake because it reminded him. And so, yeah, in our little house in Salt Lake, we had goats, lambs, chickens. We made all of our own soap. My dad made wine, distilled liquor, made our own glue, pretty much anything that you could make. We made it.
But you didn't use Windex on your zits.
No, but he did have his own concoction in a squirt bottle, just like in the movie that he...
I just watched it again and laughed myself to tears.
Oh, yeah, it's hilarious. And it's even more funny how close to home some of that stuff really is. Me and my family just get a hoot out of it.
Yeah,
it's hilarious. And then, we also, my father owned three restaurants as we were growing up, and so we had a wonderful farm and everything at home, and then we had three bustling restaurants in Salt Lake while we were growing up, and eating and the restaurant world and making product has kind of been in my life my whole life, pretty much. And then after when I turned around 18 years old, I figured I'd move to Europe and start my apprenticeship because I figured food was going to be my life. I moved to Switzerland where I started my apprenticeship, did a 4.5-year Swiss apprenticeship in butchery, charcuterie, cooking.
Oh, wow.
Everything on down, baking, pastries. Then I moved to Greece and worked on an island restaurant for the season. Moved back to...
Which island were you on?
I was in Kos.
Oh, okay.
Close to Turkey down there, next to Kalymnos.
Right.
It was a beautiful, beautiful experience.
Yeah.
A lot of work. But
I wish they'd get the country straightened out so I could go back and visit.
Yeah, I know we keep talking about it, too. I hope so, also. I mean, if it goes back to the drachma, it'll even be a little bit more affordable, so that'd be kind of an interesting interesting take.
Right.
Either which way, I have a feeling the whole Greek experience won't change much. I keep imagining in my head that 3/4 of the population hasn't even noticed yet.
I have a feeling, though, that there's a minor percentage there that's doing a new form of barbecuing. which doesn't look very good on the news reports.
Yeah, I know, right?
Well, bring us up further to date. So you were cooking for a summer.
Yeah, moved back to Europe, moved to Portland. My sister moved up here, and family moved up here from Salt Lake. And obviously, I love the town, of course, because it has so many farms and food and everything, such a big part
fabulous.
Of Portland. And moved up here, I got a wonderful job at a restaurant called Castagna. I was in a year, became the sous chef of Castagna, and then within 2 years I was the executive chef of Castagna. And when Monique offered me the executive chef job, I told her that my true passion was to make my own charcuterie and my own brand and produce meat. And so she was understanding, and she allowed me to develop, you know, a lot of curing closets and a lot of technique and really start dealing with HACCP and learning things on, as long as I, you know, ran the restaurant well. And then when I had the opportunity to open up Olympic Provisions, I jumped in, and it's been a great experience ever since.
And your product is a great experience, too. You have this little product guide, which is so whimsical and wonderful, and I love it. It sort of leads you through all the different types you make. And you actually produce quite a lot, and they're not, they're different ethnic origins.
Yeah, for sure. The book for one was a lot of fun. I'm definitely surrounded by some of the most creative people, and all my business partners are just hilarious, and we definitely have a lot of fun when we do things like the product guide, for sure. The flavor profiles and everything come from, you know, I came back from my European apprenticeship and started trying a lot of salumi that was made in America, and it was unfortunately just kind of one type. A lot of really tangy Italian-style salamis, finocchiono, soppressatas, cacciatores, which are, of course, delicious salumi, but I really missed the other types. You know, I missed the hard chorizos, I missed saucisson sec, and all the wonderful French salumi, and there's so many different types of cured meats out there that have just been overlooked in America, so I was very excited to start producing French-style salamis, Nish, and Greek-style salami.
Oh, yeah.
Just other flavor profiles that just haven't been touched on yet.
Now, to give our listeners an idea, how many different kinds do you make?
Salumi that we distribute across the nation, we make 12 different types. Products that we make out of our charcuterie, like from pâtés to hams to bacons and all that, I'd say upward of around 50 different types to 60.
So that you get from the shop, right on site?
Yep, exactly.
Okay, and you can order other ones on the Internet?
Yep, you can order the majority of our products online at olympicprovisions.com. The salami of the month has been a huge success.
Oh, yeah, tell us about that. That's fun.
Yeah, salami of the week. Since we do make 12 types, they were sitting around, of course, my business partners, the never-ending creative engine that pushes Olympic Provisions. We're saying we have 12 types. I wonder if we could do a salami of the month club and see if somebody would actually take to that. And what happens is every second Tuesday of the month, we ship you out another salami. And on that salami, you get tasting notes of what we suggest you drink with it, how we utilize it on either, you know, sandwiches or anything, dishes or recipes. And then just see what we've, you know, the little stories. Each one of our salumis have an interesting story, how I came up with a recipe or where in Europe I found it or whatnot. You kind of get this nice little package shipped out to you in the middle of every month.
Now, you're buying your pork locally?
Yes, we do about 80% of our pork is from Carlton Farms, which is here in Oregon. And then the rest of the pork that we get is what I've started doing is we do about 17 farmers markets a week in the summertime high season here at Olympic Provisions in Oregon. And we started doing processing for all the small local farmers for free. All they do is they trade me quality pork. So they'll bring in the pigs that they can't get processed in the manner that they want into pâtés and rillettes and whatnot. We'll butcher them, break them down, not charge them anything, just do a wholesale trade for my product so they are able to take my product out and resell it for a much larger margin than they would at any other shop. And then we don't charge them, and the only thing I take away from it is the quality meat that they give me. So we do that throughout the year. We'll have probably 5 to 6 different farmers that we make, really small hog organic farmers in Oregon, like 2 to 3 pigs a week maybe.
Oh,
so it's really nice. We have a lot of really wonderful connections with some great farmers up here.
And what does your father say? What does he think?
Unfortunately, my father's passed away.
Oh,
but
I'm sorry.
I'm sure he's proud.
Yeah.
Does he see anything?
My whole family works for us now. You know, my sister, he does all the books and pretty much runs the whole business and deals with the USDA HACCP program. My mother drives to the coast every week and sells salami. My nieces do all the salami of the month and packaging. It's, once again, just another big Greek family.
It's really amazing. It's sort of like in a modern city of Portland, Oregon, you've recreated Greece.
it's hilarious. It really is. You know, and it's, I think we, you know, I've been able to go to San Francisco and, you know, travel a little bit more selling my product. And every time I come back, I really forget how special Portland is. You know, we have in and out of our restaurants between the both of them, you know, 4 or 5 farmers every day. We make, I know I could go to a local bar or go out to eat and there'll be 3 or 4 artisans there, you know, be it a cheesemaker, a beer maker, somebody that makes clothing. Everybody that has kind of surrounded us has really taken it back and, you know, taken a step back and actually make products and really go slow. It's a really
we've
great place.
We've been there for various festivals and things like Wild for Game.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been to places with all the local distilleries come in and let us sample things and we interview them. I don't know. So, I mean, we've really been around Portland people and appreciate the culture there.
You just mentioned something that we should emphasize, that in addition to the charcuterie business, you also have 2 restaurants?
We have 2 really beautiful restaurants. Both are also Olympic Provisions, the name. One is in Southeast and one's in Northwest. The original one, we opened up in the industrial Southeast. Really beautiful space, also very Portland grassroots style. You know, we do all the building in our restaurants. We do all the welding, woodwork,
wow,
lay the tile, pull the electricity when we can.
I don't know how we miss those. We go to restaurants every time we're there, and we haven't missed it.
I think we're going to offer to join your family.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of fun. You have to, which I think you are willing to be able to eat for hours and hours in a moment's notice. So.
Yeah, my family is Greek, isn't it?
I think your Uncle Peter and your Auntie Anne would make a great addition to your family. But
yeah, if I liked it, yeah.
We're
easy going, and as long as you can sit around a table for a long time and laugh and drink a lot of wine, I'm sure you'll be fine.
Yeah, we'll be right at home there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
we won't miss that for a minute.
Oh, well.
That's great.
Eli, this has been great fun. Is there anything else you wanted to say before, Brem?
Thanks. It's very flattering that you guys got a hold of me and wanted to hear our little story. And
it's a great story.
Thank you very much for doing that. And whenever you guys are in Portland, please come down and give us a heads up and check, and we'd love to have some dinner and show you around my meat plant.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah.
And if anybody out there would like to purchase my product, please do at olympicprovisions.com. If you have a local cheese store or anything like that in your neighborhood that you frequent, tell them about us, and we can get them set up with products.
That's great. Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Eli.
It was a pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, here we are again, and as promised, next up interview, a truly remarkable product, I think.
I love them.
You love them. Yeah, you love them. Anne's eating them like by the handful and
not
scattering,
just me, everybody scattering else too.
Scattering a few of them on the floor as she does that. But truly, you know, what you might assume is really a failure turned into a success, and when you hear our next guest, you'll understand why I say that.
Mike Fitzgerald, I have a very obvious question to start our interview about your company and product called Half Pops, or as Peter would say, Half Pops.
just because I know how to speak the Queen's English and you don't.
Tell me, why?
Well, it actually, I'd love to say it was my idea, but a guy that I know had always liked the partially popped kernels at the bottom of the bowl.
Which we called Old Maids.
Right. And he kind of set out to figure out a way to make those, and he did it and filed a patent application on the process. So I kind of got involved about 3.5 years ago with the idea of trying to commercialize his idea, and kind of that's how it got started.
Why you? We know about why him, because we know that he liked unpopped kernels, but
which break your teeth. These do not, by the way.
What were you doing? You must have been doing something else.
I was actually a professional race car driver, believe it or not. So I'm just eminently qualified to do this, obviously.
Now we also found out, incidentally, listen, just before we came on the air, that even though you're a race car driver, you're actually a master's in industrial administration from the Tepper School at Carnegie Mellon University, right here in our city, about 3 miles from where we're sitting right now.
That is correct, yeah. And I did have a business prior to this. I was in the healthcare business, but again, there's really not much connection to the food business.
No,
that,
there's not at all.
So it was something new, and I was in between, you know, my racing career was wrapping up, and I was looking for something to do, and this kind of fell into my lap.
Yeah, now, so you really seriously raced? You were professional?
Yeah, I raced sports cars in the GT class mostly, and I raced kind of all over the world, actually, but mostly North America. But I did all the professional sports car racing series.
Yeah, did you know Paul Newman?
I met him. I wouldn't say I knew him. I had dinner with him. He's a wonderful guy.
Oh yeah, I'm really sad that he's no longer with us.
You probably know Chip Ganassi too, right?
I've met him too, but okay. I doubt he remembers that.
Yeah, he's really big time.
I never drove for him, but I did meet him.
So, but you're a risk taker if you're a professional racer, right?
I guess so.
Yes, it's of course I lived in Indianapolis for a while, and so you kind of catch the bug.
But anyway, let's find out a bit more about this patented process for creating uncooked popcorn.
Half-cooked
popcorn. seems kind of a strange idea.
It does, doesn't it?
Could I just say one thing, is that you sent samples, and I've been sampling way too much, actually. I've got to put a stop to that. And I've passed off samples to other people I know, and just across the board, everybody becomes addicted to this. They're so good tasting. I mean, they're so natural. Tell us about that.
Well, I tried, the basic product, the halfway popped kernel is it has a nice crunch and a texture to it.
And it won't break your teeth. I mean,
it's not too hard. It's softer than, say, a corn nut or a lot of other, a pistachio or something like that. But it has a nice texture and crunch to it. And I think just the fact that it's not all the way popped, it kind of holds some of the flavor in. So you don't really have to put as much seasoning on it as you might, a potato chip or some other salty snacks. It just has a naturally pretty good flavor. So we tried to put the minimum amount of oil and either butter or cheese and salt on it that we could. And then we've just made sure to use all natural ingredients. So if you have a butter and sea salt version of it, then the only ingredients that are really there are popcorn, butter, sea salt, and canola oil. That's it. There's nothing else on it.
And then you have a white cheddar one, and that's the product line. Only two flavors now. More coming, I would expect.
We actually we've had a vote going on our website for almost a year, and the three choices are kettle corn, jalapeno cheddar, and chipotle lime.
Uh-huh.
And so far, the kettle corn is pretty far ahead in the voting. So
I like the chipotle lime.
It is pretty good. We've made them all, but I suppose the next one we'll come out with will be a sweet flavor, and then the one after that would be spicy.
Uh-huh. And you have two sizes.
Yeah, we have a 7-ounce bag, which is sort of the one you'll find normally on the main grocery store aisle, and then we have a 2-ounce bag that's kind of more for the deli section or a convenience store or something like that.
Well, now, where do you get these?
Well, we're up in the Seattle area, so we're in about 70 grocery stores right now, mostly in Seattle. We're in Eli Zabar's in Manhattan, and we're in Jones on 3rd in Los Angeles, but mostly just Pacific Northwest focused, but we offer them for sale by the case through our online store at halfbots.com. So, and we offer free shipping. So it's
that's a great deal, I think.
Yeah, we've sold them in every state and a few foreign countries even. But we offer the free shipping in the continental U.S.
And that's really quite amazing. Now, I'm guessing that the objective is to be in much broader distribution to like Whole Foods kinds of places.
Yeah, we're actually going into Whole Foods in their Pacific Northwest region kind of as we speak. They've already ordered. I don't think they're actually on the store shelves yet, but they will be very soon. So yeah, we want to expand it. We're just kind of trying to grow naturally and organically from Seattle on out.
Now, do you actually do the processing yourself?
We do. In fact, I've been in the manufacturing room for, we've probably made 500,000 bags, and I've been there for every single one of them.
You can.
No, I'm not.
Now, do you just partially cook them and stop? What do you do? And it's patented. I can ask you that, right?
Yeah, we do. We don't. They're fully cooked. They just don't open up all the way like normal popcorn does. So, and we do that by manipulating the moisture content, and we do certain things differently with temperature and there's other variables that are a little bit different from regular popcorn. But yeah, it's very complicated. It's hard to do. I started off making it in the kitchen when I got involved with this, and it would take me 4 hours to make a pound of it, and then it would get devoured in 30 seconds, and everybody would be mad at me because I didn't have any more. So.
It's really funny to think that if you actually created popcorn, that would be a failure.
It is pretty amazing when you see it all come out halfway popped, because we really don't have, some people ask us if we, if we make regular popcorn and then we just throw out the regular popcorn and package up the partially pop stuff. But
that's really dumb. That's really dumb. Well, you know, this thing with the kitchen, I mean, we interviewed somebody years ago who has partially popped corn nuts. I can't remember the exact product. Wow. But it was an accident in their kitchen. They were making something else.
Right. Well, there's that wonderful Spanish nut mixture, too, that Whole Foods carries. I used to buy you every once in a while.
That has I forgot about that.
Again, has partially popped corn nuts.
Right.
Huh.
And they're really good, too. But the idea that you can build a business around half doing something, it's really quite remarkable. I must, we must see if we can find out other half-finished food products. or we can sell half-finished books. I guess we can do half-finished radio programs, too.
Oh, my God. I'm so glad to hear of Betty Ossoff's product, too, because I've begun to I kind of sneak it out of the cupboard all day long.
Which she does, and sometimes she spills them on. The only hazard is when they spill on the kitchen floor.
Oh, yeah, that's one thing. That my only objection is I thought the first time that it was just a fluke. The back seam of the bags come loose, and it spills out. But then I found that all of them did that. Maybe I'm just not opening them properly.
Yeah, you need a college course and you need
an opening my
half pops 101.
Well, we're working on a tear notch because they are kind of difficult to open right now.
Okay, so that the tear notch will make that easier.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Because as Peter says, I've spilt I don't know quantities of it all over the kitchen floor.
Well, it's a fun product.
You're fun to talk to.
You're a fun guy. I can't believe your career profile. And who knows what you'll do next? But I guess you'll be half popping for a little while at least.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Mike Fitzgerald, for joining us today on The Menu.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Thanks.
And we'll be back with today's final segment right after this short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, you may not like the sound of it because it sounds so healthy, but I think you'll like the taste. Let's listen to Keith Warrer talk about kale chips. Well, we're never short of interesting subjects as long as there are all these wonderful creative people out there writing books and devising new dishes and creating new snacks, which Americans love.
Stacks of snacks.
But anyhow, we're going to be talking to Keith Warrer. Is that a correct pronunciation, Keith?
That's a very good pronunciation.
Oh, good. Who is co-founder and creative director of a company called Rhythm Superfood, which, among other products, produces, of all things, kale chips in different flavors, right?
That's right. We have 5 different flavors that we make right now.
Okay. Do you want to describe what this actually is? Because kale chips might sound a little odd if nobody's seen them.
Well, and they are. They're unique. They're different. I don't think a product quite like this has ever come to the marketplace. But the kale chip phenomenon has I think its roots in the natural foods world, and it's going through kind of a real popular.
I was going to say, kale itself is on every restaurant menu, cookbooks.
It's hugely popular.
But why?
And it deserves to be. Usually foods that are hugely popular, oftentimes it doesn't necessarily have much value to it, but I think kale is something that is now moving away. It used to be known just as the garnish on the plate, and now for a lot of people it can actually be a main course.
Now, for those who are not familiar, listening, who are not familiar with, shall we say, the nutritional value, what is kale particularly known for in terms of minerals and things like that?
Well, kale is a nutritional powerhouse. It's an excellent source of vitamin A, vitamin C, and vitamin K. It's rich in antioxidants, phytonutrients, and carotenoids. It contains a lot of other vital nutrients, including minerals like potassium, manganese, calcium, copper. It also is a good source of fiber. So I think the thing about it is it's got a little bit of everything and a bunch of stuff.
Sort funny thing is, in the supermarket, if you see it fresh, it's a little bit off-putting, isn't it? You just kind of figure out how to handle it.
What?
I think it's intimidating for some people.
Yeah, I think that's, don't you think so? Well, you've eaten kale.
I've eaten kale my whole life, yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of people wouldn't buy because it looks kind of weird.
I think most Americans haven't grown up eating it. And there's some that probably they were maybe closer to the farm or closer to, you know, growing their own food.
Yeah, that's what happened in my family. So that's why, probably. Yeah,
and so those folks are familiar with it and know how to prepare it and cook it. I mean, it has a long history of cultivation, over 1,000 years, all over the world, really. So it's been around, but I think in the industrial era, we kind of lost track of our leafy greens and we moved away from the dark leafy greens and started consuming, mostly the iceberg lettuce kind of took over. And green cabbage kind of has always had its place, but I think the leafy greens are making a comeback.
There are different varieties. It appears to me in the product samples you sent that you use the leafy, the curly leaf?
We use a green curly kale.
How did you decide upon this? Were you sort of in love with kale your whole life, but you said, there's this new way we could prepare it? I mean, intuitively obvious.
You know, the first, I actually had kale chips. Someone had made kale chips at a raw foods potluck. Here in Austin, Texas, and to the potluck, and I thought they were really a great idea. At the time, I had just started a juice bar in Austin called Daily Juice, and we were into juicing kale and mixing our kale juice with things like carrots to sweeten it up. We were enjoying kale that way already, and I was starting to make some prepared foods, and I was making a bar, selling them around town, and I started experimenting with other types of product, all in this raw food, gluten-free, superfood, in that vein. And so when I tasted those kale chips at the potluck, I just kind of planted a seed in my mind that if I ever get the chance, I'd really like to start making something like that. So when everyone was enjoying them at this potluck. A couple years later, I started a commissary kitchen where we were developing a lot of products. And one of the products we created was a kale chip. And we started bagging them up and selling them at the local farmers market. And we brought them to the local Whole Foods market and other natural food stores here in Austin.
Oh, so that's a good place.
Well,
yeah, good place to.
Yeah, that's a good place to approach Whole Foods, I guess, right?
It is. There's a, you know,
since it's the headquarters. Since it's the headquarters.
Yeah, we're planning as soon as possible to make a trip to Austin, since the food scene, restaurant scene, and everything has blossomed so much.
It's amazing. It's amazing. The food culture here is just off the chart. And the music too. And there's a lot of beautiful things to see. I recommend y'all come here.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're having a great time. How do you make a kale chip?
So what we do is we make essentially a dressing that has a nut or a seed component to it, and it has a spices, and it has a salt, a sea salt component, and it'll have something along the lines of like a lemon juice or a lime juice, a little bit of vinegar. So basically what we're doing is we create a salad dressing.
Yeah, that's like one's ranch, another one's curry, actually, right?
Yeah, we do. We have a cool ranch, and we have a zesty nacho, which has a nice cheesy flavor, but it's dairy-free. We have a Bombay curry, we have a Texas barbecue, and then we have our most exotic flavor, I think, is the mango habanero. So we make a dressing, and we toss the fresh kale in this dressing. Essentially, at that point, you have a kale salad. But then we put that kale that has been tossed in the dressing into a dehydrator.
That's what I thought.
At low temperatures, we air crisp. We bring these things to a dry crispiness, and the flavor from the dressing sticks to the chip, and it coats the chip. It turns the kale leaf it dries it out, and it sort of shrinks it up a little bit, but it still has that dressing on it, and it just creates this great crunchy experience with all the flavors from the savoriness from the curry spices or, you know, whatever the spices are that are on the particular flavor. The nut or the seed that went into the dressing kind of helps to create the crunch experience.
Yeah, there is a crunch. They're not exactly low-cal, though.
Yeah, that's not something we were shooting for. per se. We were going for nutrient density. The nutrient, and what a more, I think a more evolved way to look at calories is to consider them, are they empty calories, or are these nutrient dense calories that your body needs and can use? And that's the case with these chips. You know, the mm-hmm. calories that are in the kale chips come from the nuts and the seeds that we use.
Of course, they're popping into my mind, would you rather have kale chips or vodka?
Exactly.
I'm joking.
Sometimes
Peter looked at me like yeah.
Sometimes something. Both.
No, sometimes she has them at the same time. Well, now where to get Rhythm Foods kale chips?
Well, we're available in most Whole Foods markets and a lot of natural food stores around the country. Vitamin Cottage, places I believe like Ralph Raley's on the West Coast. Fresh.
Do you sell from your website?
We do sell from our website. Okay. You can buy online.
And you have a store finder at your website?
You can find us on Amazon.com as well. Okay. Yeah, our website is rhythmsuperfoods.com.
Yeah, why don't you spell rhythm, because people are notorious about not being able to spell.
Rhythm is a tricky word because it doesn't have a vowel outside of a Y. R-H-Y-P-H-M, superfoods, superfoods.com.
What led to the name?
Well, that kind of came from my history and my interest in music.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm a musician, and I found that music is a part of my whole creative process. So if I'm in the kitchen and I'm getting creative in the kitchen, which is what I do for a living, music is a big part of it. I have to have music on. It's all music to me.
Oh, well, that's good.
So rhythm, it also has a connotation in terms of, like, the rhythm of your body. Everything is rhythm. There's rhythms to the whole universe. So I think it has a lot of different connotations that I like.
Well, I'm sure if you're expanding so rapidly that these products have been really well received, right?
Yeah, I feel really blessed to be in a position to be able to be a part of the health revolution that's going on in this country, be able to contribute to it.
Well, we'll see you soon, maybe in Austin. That will be fun, and you can tell us all the secrets that you don't want to tell us on the air about all the new products you're working on, because I'll bet you're working on some.
We have some good stuff coming up.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining us today, and Rhythm Superfoods kale chips are certainly on our menu.
Yes. Thanks, Keith.
Thank you for your time, and I appreciate the opportunity. It was fun talking.
And listeners, that's all until next week, where we hope we'll see you again, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.